to Projector Room, our lovely podcast where we talk about film, cinema and TV till the cows come home. I'm here as usual with Gareth. Hello, Gareth.
Hello there. How are you, Ted?
I'm all right, thank you. And it's Wednesday the 1st of April and it's show 207. And our website, if anyone ever visits it, is projectorroom.co.uk. And we natter about stuff, hopefully, in our MeWe group as well. So there's that. And et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, there's a couple more et ceteras, isn't there?
Yeah. Hey, guess what? Tech Addicts podcast is back on Sunday. I just thought I'd mention that. We will be back with the whatever season it is for 2026 because it's April. And so watch out for that one on Sunday, everyone, where we'll be talking about technology, won't we?
I'm looking forward to hearing that. Yeah.
And taking part in it, hopefully, not leaving me in the lurch. GarethMiles.com is where you'll find some real interesting stuff, project-based stuff that Gareth has been piling up there because he's got nothing better to do with his time. So have a look at that because it's really interesting. And TedSalmon.com is where you'll find all my junk and links to all our MeWe groups and our audio podcasts and all the stuff we do. Now, I completely forgot until about an hour ago that it was my turn to do Fandom Focus. And so I quickly thought to myself, whoops, what am I going to do? And I decided that one of the things that always I've been a fan of is the performances.
Hang on, folks. He did have something in there, but I told him to take it out. We are not talking about Pornhub this week at all, okay? So he had to rethink. Go back and find something else.
You lying hound. So I thought I would do Leonard Rossiter because I thought to myself, I've always been such a huge fan. The first time that Leonard Rossiter came to my attention was really in... Reggie Perrin. So in the mid-70s, I was just transfixed by the fall and rise of Reginald Perrin, and I couldn't leave it alone, and I was waiting for every episode as it came out. It went through one series, then a second series, then a third series, and then after he died, the actor in real life, they even did a fourth series called The Legacy of Reginald Perrin. And that was, it wasn't anywhere near as good because he wasn't in it, but it was still really interesting for the long-term fan to be watching it. So Reggie Perrin was written by David Nobbs, and it was just so funny and brilliant, and half the time Leonard Rossiter was just given free rein to be ad-libbing and doing what he wanted, and it's just so obvious. When you watch the episodes, you can just see when he switches into the showman and he's just doing his own thing, and it's really, really good. Worth reading the books as well, incidentally. But anyway, on with my... fandom. I was looking through the stuff that he's been in, right back to 1962, ITV television playhouses, Z Cars. I remember watching Z Cars with my dad back in the 60s. The Avengers he was in, it was only in one episode of that, but Steptoe and Son. I remember him playing this criminal in Steptoe and Son. He was only in one episode, but it was a real significant episode where he, him and his mate broke into the Steptoe house, and the whole episode was based around him trying to get away from the law who were chasing him, and it was really interesting. Then you had Rising Damp, which was again just brilliant. In fact, Rising Damp was before Reggie Perrin, but it was just so well done. Later on, perhaps less so, Tripper's Day was when he was playing this manager of a supermarket, and that was really good as well, but it was not a patch on what the early stuff was like. He just seemed to, in the early days, be given, as I say, free rein to pretty much do what he wants to do. But you might remember him more from some of the films he was in. Like, for example, he played a part in 2001 A Space Odyssey. Oliver, he was so funny and dark and menacing in Oliver. This is Oliver, the the musical, and he plays the funeral director, and he just is so evil looking and menacing and nasty, and he just does it so well. He was in one of the Pink Panther films, I think.
Strikes Again.
Water. Do you remember Water? The film called Water.
Yes. That was,
so some of these films, perhaps I ought to hand over to you, because I think you probably will have a more rounded thing than early television with me, won't you?
Well, I do know Kubrick used him a couple of times. I can think he was in Barry Lyndon as well as 2001. Yeah. I don't know if he was in any others. I can't recall, but for him to get a call back from Kubrick, you know, Kubrick must have been a fan. Mm-hmm. And I do remember Water. I think that was his last production or film that he was in.
Right.
It wasn't a great film, to be honest. I do like Michael Caine comedies, but that was at the time where he was just doing anything for the money.
Yeah.
And Leo Rossiter was pretty good in that as well. But he also did another Michael Caine film called Deadfall. That's worth checking out too. Oh, okay. That was quite a good one.
1968.
Yeah, it would have been about that.
Mm-hmm.
And then was the Voyage of the Damned as well. He was in that too, which was a quality big screen drama with a massive ensemble cast. That it was Faye Dunaway was in that, and Max von Sydow and the like. Mm-hmm. I think James Mason was in there as well. I was having a quick look at his Wikipedia, and it said that he was evacuated during the Second World War to Bangor in Wales.
Ah.
That's near you.
It is. It is where I am now. Yeah. No, I didn't know that. It was a shame, though, that he kind of died young. Great shame. How old was he? I can't remember now. But he
57.
57, yeah. And he was.
And he died
was,
on stage as well.
Well, just he was just about to go on stage, but yeah, he was you know, in action and doing his stuff. He was just a genius, and you could see that he was frantic. Everything he did was frantic, and he was always on the move and couldn't stay still. And you can see that again in Reggie Perrin, that whenever he's on camera, he's just twittering and moving and you know, on to the next thing, and it's all quick fire, and all the kind of clever oration, which, you know, in those days of the likes of Ronnie Barker, for example, being really clever with words and learning stuff really carefully so that you can put it out and make it funny. Really, really good. He was indeed a genius. Britannia Hospital, you were talking to me about that a while ago, I think.
That's right. Yeah, we I can't remember why we got onto this. Someone, I think, was in it and passed away.
Possibly. Right, okay. And he was in that. I haven't seen that yet, but
have you ever read any of his books? I know he wrote a couple of books, or maybe a few.
No, I haven't.
Okay.
I will look into that, though, if you recommend them.
No, I don't know. I've never read them. I wondered what kind of books they were. You know, like Robert Shaw wrote books, and they weren't what you'd kind of expect from Robert Shaw. I can't remember what they are, but I remember going, really?
Right. Oh, here we go. Rossiter wrote two books, The Devil's Bedside Book, 1980, and The Lowest Form of Wit, 1981. So his writing days were like 1 year.
Well, you know, maybe one of them was his magnum opus, and the second one was a follow-up that was required to...
The first one was a collection of cynical dictionary definition in the style of Ambrose Bierce's The Devil's Dictionary. And the second one was a collection of biting bonds, mots, whatever that means, bon mou, no doubt, stinging retorts, insults and sarcasms, illustrative cartoons.
That's good.
Yeah, but in fact, both of those sound good, aren't they? We'll have to get them. I shall have to get them, because I'm the fan.
I do like those alternative dictionaries. I know Douglas Adams did one as well, called The Meaning of Lif, where words for things that don't exist, really, yeah, or that don't have words to describe them, mm-hmm, like the thing at the back of the kitchen cupboard that you don't know. So yeah, the Devil's Bedside Book sounds good. Cynical Dictionary of Definition.
And there's also the stuff that he did with Joan Collins, which is really funny. I think a lot of that was those Chin Sano adverts. So they would do right, this series of skits where Joan Collins would ask him what the time was. He'd have a glass of Shinzano in his hand. He'd turn his wrist to look at his watch and pour the drink all over her. And that theme carried on through most of them in different ways. Either her just missing them and jumping out the way, or getting soaked. And they were actually really well done. And the joke was that he played as if he hadn't realised he'd done it each time, you see. It was only Joan Collins that had realised that he'd done it. He was oblivious to what he was doing. So that was really funny. And that would have been in the kind of middle 70s, late 70s, I suppose, when Shinzano was all the rage with the likes of Margot Ledbetter, and the 70s were a good time for British TV. I think I really liked it. There was so many original sitcoms, like Reggie Perrin being a really good example, and they just ran with stuff. It was so good.
Something they can't capture now, because they did have Martin Clunes played Reggie Perrin,
later on,
but it wasn't quite up to snuff.
No, I think I liked it more than most people, but yeah, it was a bit of a stretch because it didn't have the depth of the original. But yeah, it was okay. So yeah, Reggie Perrin, or I should say, Leonard Rossiter, was my fandom focus, and I really, really liked him, and it's a shame he died so young. There you go.
It is 1984, so it was Water was the last film, but it was released posthumously, right. After he died,
and he was quite funny in that as well. Anyway, there you go. Yeah. Your turn next time. See if you can forget as well till the last minute. Right, Flop of the Fortnight is next. What have you got?
Well, I've got one that I'm sure 90% of the people listening to this will go, no way. But I took it on good authority that Lake Mungo was a classic horror film, one of the best examples of a found footage horror movie. And it's an Australian film that I think Second Sight did a huge 4K or Studio Canal, one of the big boutique Blu-rays, did a huge release for it, and giving it extra special treatment and things. And it was one of the After Dark films from the After Dark Film Festival a number of years ago, and I think it was one of their big gets, and that really sprung it into action, and people started watching it after that. But the reviews are generally through the roof for it as a horror film, but I just did not get on with it. And I feel like I need to apologize to people, but I found it really boring. And those slightly scary bits that came along were few and far between, not terribly effective. I reckon that perhaps this is one of those horror films that maybe lesser experienced horror aficionados are happy to contend with, a bit like the sort of The Darkness Falls or The Wrong Turns or the Saw movies or something like that, the ones that they're just crowd pleasers, but and this maybe just spooked people out as a wee chiller that they happened to pick up, and they felt they gave themselves a pat on the back for having discovered it. But it's not really a big find. It's merely okay, and I got through it, but it was hard work. I found the performances to be somewhat off the mark for this type of film. It deals with a missing child who goes obviously missing, and they're sort of chasing the last steps through video footage, and it's filmed like a pseudo documentary, where the parents will talk about what's going on. And there's a big red herring in the middle of the film as to what is happening and what constitutes the spooky footage that's been picked up so far. And it felt like, why is this here? That's not right to put this in, because it actually takes away from the big scare toward the end. And when the big scare arrives, because of the way it's filmed, it's, you know, they're hoping that the low quality of video or video phones back in the day will provide that sort of glimpse of something hidden in the dark, but it's difficult to make out even in 4K. And I just, you know, I couldn't bring myself to really be bowled over by this film at all. And I understand what people might enjoy, but I think there's much better films out there, and those that say that this is absolutely brilliant need to go away and experience a good bit more. Now, one of the people who recommended this was on YouTube. There's a guy called Planet CHH. Christian's a really good guy. He's got really good taste, and he was the one who said, you know, if you get this film, sit down, watch it, close the curtains, turn off your phone, throw it across the other side of the room, and focus on this because it'll really creep you out. And I did that because I was really expecting this to be a spooky movie, because I knew about it. I'd heard about it a number of times, and I finally got around to getting it and watching it. And, you know, an hour in, I was drumming my fingers. By the time the big reveal comes at the end, I couldn't help but go, all right, okay, fair enough. The parents seem to be less emotional than I expected them to be with a missing child, but you know, it didn't work for me, and I'm sorry. I know that it's got its lovers. Have you ever seen this, Ted?
No. And the whole, as you know, the whole found footage thing for me is such a turn-off. I was watching one of the trailers, which we're going to come to later, that's got found footage in it, and just reflecting on that. And I thought, I think the main problem I got with found footage is that it makes me feel sick, because like any handheld camera thing, like, you know, the Blair Witch Project, famously, it's just like I look away from the screen because it just makes me feel sick. It's not scaring me, it's just like having seasickness almost for me. And so this whole found footage thing, I think, tends to be a bit like that for me. And so I wouldn't have even kind of looked at this, to be honest, even if I knew of its existence. But it's a shame that you seem to be the only other person apart from me that didn't want to go with it.
Yeah. Obviously, I'm wrong, because I'm very much in the minority. But that wouldn't be the first time.
Fair enough. Okay, let's get on to private screening instead, then, and something possibly a bit more palatable. What was your film?
Well, I decided we should watch a little action movie, because we've been very dramatic and forthright with our choices over the last while. I just wanted a good old fashioned, solid, almost direct-to-video action film, but I know you need your quality, so it was something a wee bit of a step above the rest of those action movies that we get direct-to-video. This one stars Dave Bautista and Bobby Cannavale, and it's about a DEA agent and his partner who are pursuing thieves, their own rebellious teenagers, who have begun robbing the cartel that the DEA is currently investigating. It's a film that's actually, I looked at The Rip recently, and I started thinking that this is a wee bit of like a, almost like, you know, the way you get a big movie and then you get the direct-to-video version of that movie. This could be that, where this is the cheap version of the big Ben Affleck starring Matt Damon film. But it's not. I think this film has a few merits. I was able to watch this with my son. It is rated R, but I don't think it's particularly R-rated at all. And it's not a youth adventure movie. Is it YA, I think they call it? You know, like the Mortal Machines, or I can't remember. But they make a lot of sort of... Harry Potter would be a youth adventure movie. This is... this does have a sort of youth focus to it, where the youth are a big part of this film, but I think they're actually kind of a believable part of this film, in that the action level is what you could expect from a regular, normal, violent action movie. Not overly violent, just violent enough. But it has the kids in there as well, which puts in quite a bit of peril. I remember there was a film with Tom Sizemore and Stephen Baldwin years ago called Sky Kids or something like that. And it was a proper action movie that they'd thrown kids into. Not an action movie with kids, but a proper big budget action movie that had kids dangling, you know, and having to partake in the action. And whilst it is a step below what you'd expect Jason Statham or Ben Affleck to appear in, it's a different level that they keep it at. And I felt that worked in this respect. And I became a wee bit interested in the plot as it went along, whenever I realized where they were going with this, because it takes its own course. And with Dave Bautista and Bobby Cannavale providing really solid, almost A-list anchoring for the film, it could sway around it. And Tony Dalton from Better Call Saul as the big villain, that just made things, you know, a wee bit more intense whenever it comes to a potentially youth-focused action movie. And I really got on quite well with it. It's not a fantastic movie by any stretch of the imaginations, but it's an entertaining 90-minuter that has some good action sequences and a slightly more believable plot. And I know that you've got the caveat of these are kids, so obviously they can't be using lethal force to do what they're doing, but they managed to get away with it all right without completely having to suspend your belief of what's going on here. And I'm quite interested to see what you thought of it, Ted, because I quite liked it.
Right. Well, the fact that I think that the film's main failure is the obsession with the teenage cast, who I didn't think were at all well acted, and the whole kind of school thing and the American school and the spunky kids on a mission to save their friend. Frankly, the premise of the film was absurd and stupid, and the teenagers were just making stupid decisions all along, and they were dumb. And
teenagers.
All right, yeah, but I don't particularly want to watch that. But going back to what you were saying about the performances, I think that Bobby Cannavale was really good. Unfortunately, he was underused, and Dave Bautista, who I completely disagree with you on, I thought he was a terrible actor. He just looked like an actor trying to act, and he was outclassed at every turn when Bobby Cannavale was in the room. He just wasn't convincing. He was just like this muscled thug that they almost felt like he'd, you know, been roped in to be a muscled thug. And I just didn't buy his character at all because of what he was like as an actor. I did like the other really, really underused character in the film called Teresa, and she was really good. She's been played by this girl called Indy Navarette, who I'd never heard of her. But when she came onto the show, she was really sharp and her character was really good. She was clearly a really good little actor, and she just was wasted because I'm glad to say, spoiler alert ahead, I'm glad to say that the very clear inference from the end of the film was that she'll be back for the next one. But she should have been the centre of this film because she was just so good and so chilling, and it just worked really well what she was doing and the reveals around her character. Probably given away too much there already, but there you go. But because of the whole teen thing and the whole script being kind of just ridiculously fun, far-fetched and unlikely and all the rest of it. It came across to me like a kind of a mix-up between a Disney Channel film and an episode of Scooby-Doo. The episode of Scooby-Doo thing was really relevant because that seemed to be what they were doing. They were on this, and they even had a Scooby-Doo van at one point. You know, they were going around in the van, and it just, this is Scooby-Doo, and it's a bunch of spunky teenagers trying to go and fix something that's wrong, and it's come on, for goodness sake. And I knew you were going to say what you said. I could see you sitting there with your son watching this. I thought, yeah, this is what this is about. This is a parent and child film to watch together. And sure enough, it's the first thing you said. But no, it wasn't for me. But I did like Bobby Cannavale, and I think it was worth watching for him. And also, as I say, Indy Navarette, I think she was really good. But apart from that, no, Dave Bautista was just awful.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, he's an actor who has come on. Yeah, he's more of a presence, a bit like Arnold Schwarzenegger. You know, he wasn't the greatest actor when he first started out, and he kind of grew into being a better actor. And Dave Bautista, I think, has really improved his arc, I suppose, over the years. I don't think he's ever going to win an Academy Award at this rate. But there's a couple of films that I have seen him in recently, like Showgirls. With Pamela Anderson,
dear.
He was particularly good in that as well. So I think he's really developing as an actor. But I guess for me, this, because I've seen so many direct-to-video action films in my life, I was expecting that level, and this was a wee bit above that, and it had an extra hook to put in there. It had an extra level of interest going on. And I just felt it was a cut above the rest. It's not a phenomenal movie. I wouldn't say rush out tomorrow and get yourself a copy or jump on Amazon Prime and rent this because it's a must have. But it is a bit of interesting fun, I suppose, and you could just enjoy it. It's 90 minutes of undemanding, fairly decent action. Yeah.
I can see why you would say that. It's just not for me. I'd rather be watching something else.
Yes, you want the other type of Trap House, didn't you?
I'm going to give it 5 for those two actors mainly. And I can see what you're saying. If you were the right kind of person who would be wanting to watch this kind of, you know, thing, like you just described, this action, low-level kind of thing, yeah, fair enough. But it's just not for me, so I'm scoring it 5.
And obviously that's out of 15, dear folks, just to be different about things. 5 out of 15, I think, is a wee bit low, but I'm going to go with 8. I'd say it's a wee bit above average. I think 8 is a suitable score. If you like just clean-cut action movies, yeah.
Okay, that gives it a total of 13, which puts it in the company of The Gorge. I can't believe The Gorge is down there. Exposed.
God, I can. That's
House of Ninjas.
Turd.
And stop it, go away. And also...
Tender Mercies. How can that have 13? Dear, dear. What a great movie.
Yes. Well, don't forget, I only saw half of that.
you have to watch the whole film to experience the whole film.
The scoring of our table without Alan here is going to be a little bit skewed, but it's only a bit of fun. So hang it. Okay, now I've got a confession to make for my choice for next time. I have seen the first episode of this, and this is actually the reason I put it in here, because I think it's got real good potential. It's just arrived on Netflix, called Something Very Bad Is Going to Happen, and it's 8 episodes, each 45 minutes.
Oh, spoiler.
What?
Spoiler.
What's the spoiler?
Well, something bad is coming. You just told everyone.
Oh, sorry. Something very bad is going to happen. Yeah. So, 8 episodes, each 45 minutes. It's got Ted Levine in it and Jennifer Jason Leigh. And I watched the first... And Camila Maroney if that's how you pronounce it, is in the female lead. And in the first episode, it was really intriguing. And I, for one, am going to carry on watching it. And I think that you should too. And I think we should both do it and then come back and let it be my private screening next time, even though it's a little bit of a cheat having watched the first one. So is that all right?
No.
All right. I'll yes, choose something fine. Else. I'll choose something else then. The Maltese Falcon.
Ooh, I haven't seen that one. No, that's fine. Something very bad is going to happen. Cool. Hopefully it happens in the first episode.
I wouldn't like to say. right. Yeah, and the usual rules apply. You know, if you watch one or two episodes and you think this is rubbish, then we don't need to watch it on. But having seen the first one, I think that it's got potential, and I think it'll be good. But anyway, we'll see. So pick a theme is next, and the theme treats that I chose last time is food, and I think you should start with the one where your cursor is, because that looks great.
Attack of the Killer Tomatoes? Yeah, it is. Early George King. No, I'm joking. It is about food, I suppose, but it kind of counts. I approached this kind of seriously, but then I started thinking outside of the box again, because that's fun, isn't it? Tampopo is a Japanese comedy about... I'll read this plot description because it's the easiest way. A truck driver stops at a small family-run noodle shop and decides to help its fledgling business. The story is intertwined with various vignettes about the relationship of love and food. I saw this a number of years ago. It might have been something to do with Mr. Gilday suggesting that I do, or possibly a girl that I know who said it was very good. Yeah, I think actually it was her. Yeah, thanks, Claire. This was a decent little Japanese comedy that is, you know, it's got a bit of heart to it. It's got a few chuckles along the way. And I think it's one of those sort of classic movies that the country would be quite proud of. I don't think it has a particularly big audience over here, but it's worth checking out as a nice movie. It doesn't have anything too dark in it, and I reckon, Ted, you'd probably quite like it too.
Yeah, I watched the trailer and it looked really good. And I do remember one of our MeWe Group members, recommending that I watch this. And I can't remember who it was, but someone recommended it. And it might have been Carl Young, actually. And he said, yeah, you should watch that, because I've been banging on about something else. And I think that the thing that I've been banging on about was my first choice here, which is Sweet Bean. And Sweet Bean is a film from Japan again, 2015, which I spoke about on the show before, so no need to keep banging on about it. But it's a really interesting film about three people. It's a character study, really. This guy who runs this bean pancake bean house, kind of on the side of the street in Japan somewhere, and how he is in trouble because he can't get the sauce right. And then a young girl comes along, and she's one of the customers, and she's trying to work out her future and what she wants to do with her life and blah, 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 blah. And then an old lady comes along who, it turns out, has got the magic sprinkle dust to make the sauce for the pancake that he needs to turn the business around and to stop the owner of the business kicking him out and closing it down. And it's just a really, really nice little art house film, which is really hard to get hold of. I've got the DVD, which I bought yonks ago, but it's really hard to get hold of, but it's really, really nice if you can. It's the sort of film that comes round on MUBI or something now and again, and it's really nice. It's made by the same people that I think were involved in Shoplifters. No, I tell a lie. I think the woman that's in it was also in Shoplifters. Yeah. Mr. what?
Mr. Bean. He's not in it, is he?
No, Mr. Bean is not in it. It can't be. It couldn't be further away from Mr. Bean. So yeah, there you go. There's my first one, and really, really lovely film. All to do with the food, and you watch them in the kitchen. You watch him in the kitchen doing this stuff, and then her making her sauce, and it's all focused on very, very much on the food. Really nice. What's your next one?
Okay. Well, there's a TV series, but I know there's also they edited the TV series into a series of movies. It's called The Trip with Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon, and they basically play themselves touring around. I think it's a different country in each season or each series, and they go to a restaurant and review the food, but it's not so much about the reviewing of the food. It's about their relationship and them just having a laugh together and talking and doing impersonations and all those sorts of things. There's tiny little bits of backstory about how it's almost like they're lampooning themselves in a way, where Steve Coogan's career's kind of taking off and he's got a son who won't speak to him, but it's not a focus of the actual series, and it's just something that happens in the background as it happens. Like you're at work with someone and you hear that happening, and then you go away and you don't hear about it again at all. You know, it's completely uneventful to the rest of the series, but it is just the two of them getting on really well and entertaining each other and showing why they are such entertaining men, such funny men. And I would actually go as far to say that it's Rob Brydon at his very best. I don't know if you know him particularly well. He's from Gavin and Stacey and Whose Line? No, Would I Lie to You? The panel show. He's a Welsh comedian. It really entertains. It's a funny, funny series. I will say that I don't know what was wrong with me at the time or if I was wrong, perhaps, but the last series that they made, because I think there's maybe four or five seasons of this, about six episodes each, I did not get on well with it at all. I found it very stressful and tense between the two of them, like they were almost about to kill each other. You know, they weren't. They were having a laugh, and I thought that perhaps the comedy was going to go too far and one of them was going to snap. I was feeling really anxious throughout the entire thing. My wife can't agree with that at all. She adores this series entirely. And for some reason, they edited it all down into like 5 90-minute movies each season and put them out in the States that way because, I don't know, they don't want to watch a TV series of it or something. I don't know. I don't get it. But, have you ever heard of this or seen it?
Yeah, I've seen some of them. I certainly know who Rob Watson is. I've seen Gavin and Stacey. Gavin and Stacey, I thought his role in that was really funny. And I have seen that panel show that he did as well. I'm very familiar with Rob, what's his name? Was it Brydon?
Brydon,
yeah. Brydon, and I have seen one of the seasons of The Trip, and you're quite right. It's totally watchable. I thought it was great. I wouldn't say I thought it was great. I thought it was just watchable and interesting and a good time passer. It was inoffensive and it was funny at times, and it was kind of, you know, interesting at times, and stuff they were talking about was interesting often. Character study on the pair of them, I suppose. I suppose it's a bit like that one where he goes fishing with what's his name?
Bob Mortimer.
I suppose it's a little bit like that. It's like taking two personalities and then throwing them into a situation which is a bit different to the norm. But yeah, The Trip, I think, was made and filmed really well, and I did enjoy the one series I saw.
It'd be remiss of me not to say that it was written and directed by Michael Winterbottom.
Oh, right. Wow. Good.
There you go.
Right, my second one is The Scent of Green Papaya, a 1993 film, which I... should have seen before, because in the early 90s, I was living in an art house cinema, and I just never got round to seeing it. This is a lovely piece of art house. It really is really nice. It was right at the right time for me. I don't know why I didn't see it, but it's about this girl in Vietnam who goes to work for this family, and she is a servant in the family. This is based in 1951, during the first Indochina War, which I had to look up. I didn't know anything about that. But anyway, 1951. And it's all about her learning her duties while the family ran their little cloth and linen business. And part of that was to learn from her, the older servant, how to cook and prepare food. And the focus very much is around the food, as well as some of the characters. In the second half of the film, we moved 10 years on when she's a young woman of about, 18 or 20 or something. And she leaves the house and goes to work for one of their friends, who is a handsome young man, and he composes at his piano. And so the second half of the film turns a bit erotic, and she, it's not kind of full of porn or anything.
Are you living in a
But there's no nudity. It becomes a bit erotic at times, because what turns out is that she, as the older woman, falls for her employer, this piano composing blokey. But anyway, that's not the point, really. The point is, mainly in the first half of the film, it's about her and her learning how to cook, and that the reference to papaya is that in the middle of this house, they've got a little quadrangle courtyard where she's very fascinated by the wildlife, and there's frogs and beetles and stuff, and a papaya tree plant which grows papaya in the middle of all this. And there's some really interesting photography going on where they have real close-ups of the milk of the green papaya coming out, and her using the papaya for cooking. Anyway, if you're into cooking, that would be a really nice film for you to watch. But that's about the bones of it. Very nice.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to throw in one last one, which is the McDonald's biopic with Michael Keaton called The Founder. This is one I actually watched with my son when he was quite young, because it's a PG. It's a very, very easy little tale. I don't know how fully accurate it is, because obviously I'm sure McDonald's brand has something to do with the writing of it. But it was just a good, solid story of American capitalism during a wholesome time, where it was about making something that's going to sell and selling it well, and that was the whole ethos behind McDonald's as it was. It's changed now entirely, but it had a great cast with Michael Keaton, Nick Offerman, Patrick Wilson was in there as well. Laura Dern, you'd love it for her. BJ Novak was in there, and Linda Cardellini. It was kind of witty. It was enthralling. It was interesting. And Michael Keaton was absolutely blinding. I love Michael Keaton. He's one of the best actors out there. He's such a flexible guy. It's the perfect thing for him. He does this really well. And I'm sure you've got to have seen this at some stage.
I haven't seen it, but I do remember you and Alan talking about it on this very show at some length 2 or 3 years ago, and pretty much saying what you're saying now, really, and he agreed with you. So having seen the trailer running while you've been talking, I will watch it, because it does look interesting. You're right.
Yeah, it's a good flick. What's your last one?
My last one is Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street, which, again, I've spoken about on this show. But this is food with a different leaning. And anyone that knows, it's not a spoiler to tell people that the Sweeney Todd story is about this barber who is sent away by this nasty judge in London in the 1850s or something. And he because the judge fancies his wife, and so his wife is scooped up by the judge, and Sweeney Todd is sent off on a boat somewhere to get out the way. He, however, comes back. He was Benjamin Barker at that time. He comes back, changes his name, and starts to find a way of revenge against the judge. This is all wrapped up in Stephen Sondheim's music, taken on board by Tim Burton. So Tim Burton has brought in his usual crowd of favourite actors, you know, like Johnny Depp and Alan Rickman and Helena Bonham Carter. Timothy Spall is in there. Sacha Baron Cohen almost steals the show with his character of this rival barber showman in the town square. He is really, really funny. But the bottom line is that Helena Bonham Carter runs this pie shop, and she is doing really badly. And so Sweeney Todd, who is up for revenge on the judge and her, work out that if they lop people's heads off while he's cutting their beards and their hair, they can make pies out of them and then feed them to everyone. And so that's what happens. But as I say, that's the whole basis of the Sweeney Todd story. So it's hardly a surprise to anyone, I'm sure, that's listening to this. Great film, really good music. And one of the interesting things that Tim Burton did was, he did bring in two or three professional singers to do some of the parts, but most of them, he just let people get on with it. And you can tell when you're listening to, you know, for example, Alan Rickman trying to sing. It's like, really? But it just kind of works. It feels like it's someone singing that can't sing, and they're just ordinary people. And that, as I say, that just kind of works. The story's gripping, and the music is fantastic. I think it is, and Tim Burton's darkness comes across all over it because of the dark theme of the film. So yeah, very much about food, but just a different kind of food.
Okay. I haven't actually seen this one. I know it's been out a long time and people have raved about it to me, but it's never really felt it for this one.
Fair enough. I just think it's really good. But I like, as you know, anything that Tim Burton does, I'm all over anyway. And so this didn't have to do much else to get there. I've just noticed you have not chosen a theme for the next show. How dare you? That means that we have a gap in the running order now, while you're thinking of one really quickly and pretending you had it all the time, and you put it in there and say, ah, but I wanted to surprise you with it just at this point in the show.
Okay, yeah, no, I had one all planned out. And it's on a food type sort of level, just to keep in sync with it. Beer.
Ah, hurrah!
Good old-fashioned hops, sugar, barley, wheat, barley, I suppose, either. Boiled up nicely with a bit of flavouring, yeah, beer.
Lovely. I'm all over that. And I can think of a couple of things already, so we shall be back on the next show with that one. Let's get to the main feature. And the main feature, I did have a little group of four films here, because let's see how we're doing for time. We're under an hour. It'd be quite interesting to try and see how far we get through with these, because they're all recent releases that have just dropped onto streaming mainly. And perhaps if I try to plough through them, we might get through all four. Red Plague is a 2025 film, which is set in the aftermath of a viral outbreak. And I think you would like this, because it's quite slow, which you might not like, because you like your action stuff. But
no, I can watch slow movies.
But it feels very much like a Western. So this plague has happened somewhere. Carter is our main character. His wife dies in the opening scenes. And he he disappears into the desert to get away from the virus, which turns people basically into zombies. They're not quite zombies, but they behave like zombies. And he's living in the middle of the desert. Suddenly, one day, this girl turns up, a young woman turns up, and asks if he can help her to get to this rendezvous point with these people that she is trying to meet up with. It's a bit of a Western, as I say. It turns from a kind of survival horror thing in the first instance. There's not a huge amount of exposure to the zombie creatures at all, really, right throughout. There's a few key moments where there are, but it turns into more of a Western, really. And it's dusty and it's dry, and they've got to make their way across the desert to get to this place. They run into this really nasty crowd of blokes who are just have no intentions other than killing people and maiming them, and at that point Carter kind of turns into a gunslinger type character, thereby making it feel even more like a Western. So, yes, this is slow burning. I won't tell you any more about the plot, because they're off on their way to meet up with these people. They come across these hoodlums on the way, and I think that you'd really like it if you can just deal with the slow pace a bit. That's all. Nice film.
Yeah, it does look quite good. It's a wee direct-to-video thing that might be a bit better than the norm.
Yeah, it's a good one. My second one is Pretty Lethal. And again, I think you might quite like this for different reasons. This is a bonkers film about this group of five American ballerinas who are going off to this competition in Hungary. And on the way to this thing, their bus breaks down and they have to set off on foot to the nearest kind of place to go to, which is this kind of hotel, which is it starts to turn a bit dark and strange then when they get to this hotel, because the Uma Thurman is the manager of this hotel, working for the Hungarian mob, and the five ballerinas turning up just is not on the agenda at all, and they've got to try and work with the fact that this bunch of hoodlums who are hanging out in this hotel, which is populated by no one else, there's no one else there except that crowd, and they've got to try and find their way through this situation. In the middle of this, the girl's teacher is shot dead because she says the wrong thing by one of these loonies, and this leaves just the five girls on their own, and so they've got to then negotiate their way out of this place while all these hoodlums are trying to track them down and kill them and maim them and make sure they don't escape and tell anyone, and it just turns to this into this kind of bloody mess where and you can guess that they're all going to survive and that all the hoodlums are going to get killed, but the way in which it's done is really interesting. There's some tension in there as well, it's just really funny and really fun and very silly. And one of the girls actually in the middle of it is the girl that played in the girl that's deaf in real life, who played in, what's that film called? A Quiet Place. You know, A Quiet Place?
Oh, yes.
The deaf girl was in it. Well, she was in this film as well as one of the five ballerinas. And apparently she is seeking out roles where there is a deaf character in the film. She can speak, but she chooses not to, apparently, because she wants to make a kind of statement about actors and disability, I suppose. But the whole film is just bonkers, great fun, and very, very silly. And the ballerinas go into their kind of, the tricks that you have as ballet dancers in order to defeat all these guys who are all armed with guns, of course, and these girls are not. And it's just bonkers, but it's great fun. So that's called Pretty Lethal, and that's It's currently on Amazon Prime, actually. You'd have a bit of fun with that. And I think your son could probably watch that as well.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
I think so. It might be just on the edge. How old is he?
13.
Yeah, maybe you'll have to check it out.
Maybe I will. Millicent Simmons, what's her name?
Probably. That's the one. Yeah,
yeah. Quiet Place.
And okay. Yeah. She did really well, actually. The acting was okay in it, but it wasn't Oscar winning stuff. It was just a laugh, another director video almost. But there you go. I'll take a break from my four. What have you got?
And it was directed by Vicky Jewson, who did Close with our Noomi Rapace.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Cool.
Cool. Yeah. Well, I went to the movie theater this week and I saw, well, I went to the pictures, I guess would be the best way to say it. And I saw the new big sci-fi movie, Project Hail Mary. And it comes from someone who has read the book and enjoyed the book a great deal. And I'm very aware of Andy Weir's other film, The Martian, which I think is an absolute triumph. And I would actually say I prefer it over Project Hail Mary. But maybe after I watch Project Hail Mary a couple more times when it hits 4K or something, it might accelerate. But I think actually having read the book prior to it, it's one of those problems where, you know, there's just quite a bit cut out of the book because obviously they can't put everything in, and even at the runtime of something like 2 hours and 18 minutes long, Project Hail Mary does manage to cover quite a lot of the book, and it stays quite faithful to the book, which is generally not done in Hollywood, but here they treat it very well. It's really clever. It's a well accessible sci-fi film as well for anyone who's really worried about how some people have referred to this as a hardcore sci-fi, or not hardcore. It's another term they use for, you know, obviously not Star Wars sci-fi, but proper science-based sci-fi like The Martian. It has a lot of problem solving and all that kind of thing that is built into the fabric of everything that we understand. Mm-hmm. Everything is physically correct in the current understanding of science, so that gives this a real hook. And Andy Weir tends to write things from that point of view, so that you can understand that what you're seeing is not make believe, and everything is within the confines of what we understand now. But it's a very fun movie as well. The casting of Ryan Gosling as the main character of Grace, I've forgotten his first name, Thingy Grace, I think it's his name, his character's name is in the film, Thingy Grace, what's his face Grace? Yeah, we'll go with that. Ryland Grace, that's the one. In the book, they almost used the same mechanism that Matt Damon used in The Martian, where he was recording like a video log and you got a real insight into how funny the man was, and how he took how he used the humor to entertain the audience along the way. And they couldn't do that again, obviously, but it would have really benefited this. And if you read the book, you get that feeling that this is just a genuinely funny man. And Ryan Gosling, it's almost unfortunate you feel for him, because he can't be as humorous as Matt Damon was in The Martian, but he still manages a few bangers, and the audience was laughing throughout the theatre, here, there, and everywhere throughout the film. It is it's a properly funny movie. There's some really good bits. It's got some good drama. But I feel that it takes a step back from some of the dramas, and the emotional impact really bleeds through in the book, but it doesn't feel that focused on in this movie, because I just don't think they had the time. So it's somewhat compressed and just happens, you know, along the way, and you take it in their stride. Some people may prefer that rather than having an emotional core like that. It concentrates on the science and the characters. So it's about an astronaut who wakes up in a spaceship, traveling through space, and doesn't understand how or why he's there. But it quickly turns out, it unravels as he slowly regains his memory, as he is trying to solve a problem that is presenting the destruction of Earth. So he realizes he's on his way to save the Earth, and he does that. And on his way, and I don't think this is much of a spoiler, it was a spoiler for me when I was reading the book, because I didn't know this was going to happen. But you can tune out now for a minute or two. But it's in the trailer, and they very much push that. He meets an alien, and the two of them have to learn to communicate. They have to learn, or they get on, and they eventually become best friends. It's not Alien or Aliens. It's not an action movie in any way. It's a movie about communication and understanding, and that is very important to the film, and it gives it a fresh perspective, because we don't get that very often in a big budget sci-fi movie like this. It's not Mac and Me or something like that, or some sort of Alf the TV show. It's a bigger budget and wonderful that kind of way to experience something very different without war and fighting throughout the entire thing. It's a very detailed movie. It really goes into all the granular bits and pieces about what happens, but it's very easy to follow, and that's really important for the audience. You feel smarter having sat through this and understood it, which is brilliant. And my son and my wife and I, we really just got everything that they were talking about here. And Andy Weir has such a great way of being able to do that. The relationships in the story are interesting. There's a number of flashbacks to sort of tell the story about how and why he's there as he starts to remember things. His relationships are very well painted, in this sort of film, whenever you get a flashback, you feel like you're taken out of the story and you're enjoying where they were, and then all of a sudden you're relocated to somewhere else in a different time, and you're a bit kind of, oh, can we get back to where we were? But the flashbacks are all fine, and they're very enjoyable. And then whenever you're transported back to the current time of what Ryland is up to in space, you're kind of like, I wouldn't mind going back to the flashback. I'll look forward to the next flashback. So it's quite well layered that way. It's very light, it's very human, and it just doesn't get too heavy, which is what a lot of people were concerned about, because whenever it comes to these sort of hardcore sci-fi things, it can get too heavy, and I kind of covered that, I suppose. It is a survival story, and it's got a lot of space exploration going on there. It's got a lot of great special effects. It's got a lot of fun narratives to entertain you the whole way through, and the emotional core of it is really quite strong. And I would fully recommend it to anyone who really wants to go out and see something that's a bit of an event. And I'm so glad this is a bit of an event, that it's not Star Wars, it's not Avatar, it's not some sort of big special effects war movie that youth can go out and enjoy and come away feeling more excited about space travel, more excited about science. And, making people enthusiastic about that is only a good thing at the end of the day, rather than just war and killing. And this has come from someone who really enjoyed Trapoise. So, Ted, have you seen anything about this, or have you any interest in watching it?
We watched the trailer on Coming Soon, I remember we saying that meeting of the alien was a complete spoiler at the time. And the way that you've described it there makes it sound very attractive, and I shall definitely be watching it. I don't know how long it's going to take to get out of the cinema, but when it does, I shall definitely watch it. You've made a good case The Project Hail Mary, the first one, the 2021 one, says that it's a video and it's 16 hours.
Sorry, what?
If you click through to the Project Hail Mary 2021 Andy Weir, and it says video 2021, 16 hours, 10 minutes. Do you see that in IMDb?
Yeah, it says only on Audible, so that's the audio book. But
oh, is it? Oh, okay.
A video.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
So that's not it then. So what was the other one you said previous, at the outset, that you preferred?
Martian.
Oh, The Martian. Oh, okay. I know The Martian, yeah. Okay. So
what did you think of The Martian?
I thought The Martian was fantastic. I really, really liked it. And I watched it about three times. But you reckon The Martian was better, do you?
At this stage, yes. But I haven't read The Martian. And I think, you know, that might be the reason why people who haven't read Project Hail Mary would maybe prefer it over The Martian, because it is a bigger, grander adventure, and it's got a large amount. It feels more make-believe because it's more of a sci-fi tale, whereas The Martian does really feel like a realistic story, just well told. Okay. Whereas Project Hail Mary is the same. It is a realistic story as we would understand it, you know.
And do you know why? What's the Hail Mary Catholicism thing about? Or is that a spoiler?
The ship's called the Hail Mary.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Right. So it's like Sorcerer in that respect.
Right. Okay.
Obviously, yeah. You understand that very well, yeah.
No, I'm sorry, I don't.
Well, come and watch Sorcerer then.
Sorcerer.
Yeah, and it. I think the enthusiasm for Project Hail Mary is so big that I think his next two books, his previous book, The Egg, is going into production now as a big movie, and then his next novel, Artemis, has already been green lit, so they're very much waiting for that, and it couldn't come soon enough for most of the audience. He's hot stuff, is old Andy Weir now.
Sorcerer. How do you spell sorcerer? I'm trying to look it up now. You're talking about the Roy Scheider. Yeah. Oh yeah, I've seen that. We talked about that on the show. In fact, that was in private screening. I think we did that. Yonks ago. And yeah, you're right. It was a good film. Right. Okay. So, anything else you want to say about Project Hail Mary?
No. It's got everything that you need, and I was really pleased that it keeps it so close to the book.
Right.
The only thing is that it's one of those films that you could let go for another hour or so, and I would love for whenever it hits 4K for them to go, oh yes, this is the extended version of it, like they did with Lord of the Rings, and you get an extra hour's worth of all the stuff, and it throws in the other characters that were kind of left out. That would be wonderful. Or if they made a mini series of it, because this is so popular, the way they're doing with Harry Potter, they're bringing it back as a TV series as opposed to a series of movies.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, I shall look forward to seeing that, definitely. And I shall let you know how I get on.
Do so.
I tell you, a film that you'll really enjoy is Primate, which has just dropped onto... It's just dropped onto streaming in the UK just this week. And it's a really kind of interesting little film about this chimp that lives in this house with this rich family. And the chimp... during the night it lives in a cage, and this mongoose breaks into the cage and he attacks it, and the mongoose has got rabies, so the chimp gets rabies, and then over the course of a couple of days, when significantly the owner of the house and his main keeper has gone off to do a book signing, the chimp just slowly goes bonkers and attacks everyone and just becomes this kind of maniacal, you know, loony chimp. just at this time, also the daughter and the friends of the daughter have come for a spring break or whatever they call it, and so they've turned up at the house. Dad's gone away, and in the middle of all this, this chimp is attacking these young party going girls and gals. And they have to basically try and survive. It turns into a survival film, and there's about half a dozen youngsters who are at peril. Now, in the end, they decide that chimps don't like going into the water, so they get into the swimming pool, and the chimp is watching them and biding his time, and it's all very well kind of designed, and it's quite tense at times and sinister, and it's just a lot of fun, really. It's all very silly, but it's a compelling watch, and I really enjoyed it. It's not a long film particularly, and it was just really good fun. And there is some gore and some nasty stuff going on. So you do see, you know, a couple of times where the chimp rips someone's head off or tears their jaw out from their head. And there is some graphic stuff going on and lots of blood and stuff. And so it's not for the faint-hearted, I guess, but it's just lots of fun and worth a watch. So that's Primate, recommended. I think you'd like it.
Yeah, the director is Jonas Roberts, who I've actually been a fan of for a good few years. He directed a film called Dark Hunters back in the early 2000s with Jeff Faye that I was actually a really big fan of. And I followed his films, not very closely, but do you remember 47 Meters Down?
Oh, yeah,
and then,
yeah.
Sequel, 47 Meters Down, Uncaged?
Yep, yep.
He directed both of those as well.
Yeah.
And he did one of the Strangers films.
Oh, right.
I don't know which one. Is that the first one? Prey at Night.
I've seen the first one. The other two I've not.
I don't think he did the first one. I think that was Rennie Harlan, was it not? No, that's Strangers Chapter One. This is Strangers Prey at Night. This is the direct-to-video sequel to the older film with Liv Tyler, was it? I think. Yes, okay. Sorry. All right. Yeah. But yes, he's a very good horror director. And yeah, I'll give this a go, especially if you're ranting and raving about it. So
it's just good fun. It's just violent fun, and it's all very silly at the end of the day. But it's violence for the sake of it. And these, you know, there's bikini clad girls in the middle of it all, and it's
all right. You've sold me. I'm going to watch it.
The last one I've got is called Hallow Road, and this is a odd little film about this woman and this bloke who wake up in the middle of the night and realise that their daughter has nicked his car. They've still got her car. And the whole film, pretty much, in the style of Locke or The Guilty, there was two The Guilty films we talked about on the show before, where the whole film, pretty much, is shot inside the car on the journey. They jump into her car, and they've got to get to where the girl is. And as the journey unfolds, it turns out that the daughter has told them that she's run someone over, and she thinks she's killed them. And then it turns out that she was high on drugs. And so they're racing to the scene, talking to her on the phone while they're going. But the drive is 40 minutes. And so there's a long time, and the film pretty much does that, you know, minute for minute. It's the 40 minutes is taken with the drive. And of course, everything is not quite as it seems. And when they eventually do get there, there are twists and turns ahead as well. But the strength of the thing is really in the dialogue in the car. And I was really, really impressed with Rosamund Pike. She plays the lead, the woman. And honestly, when some of the situations where she finds things out and she's driving, and then Frank, the husband, played by Matthew Rhys, is arguing with her, and she's trying to do the best thing. Turns out that she's a first responder, so, you know, a paramedic. So she kind of knows what to say to her daughter over the phone to try and, you know, find out if the girl is dead. She gets her to do CPR on her and blah, blah, blah. But the point I'm making really is that Rosamund Pike is just so convincing. She, you know, even in a little almost kind of straight to video film like this, she just shines above everyone else as being the actor that they paid the money for.
I don't know, this went straight to video. I think this did theaters last year.
Did it? Okay.
Yeah. Remember there was a bit of a hubbub about it.
Okay. So, not to tell you anything about the twists and the turns and the outcomes, but just to say that if you liked Locke and The Guilty and that kind of thing, then there's a good bunch of tension in the car. And again, I think you'd really like this one, Gareth. What was that one we were watching where that guy had got trapped in his car in the snow? What was that called? We both talked about that on the show. That was a very similar kind of thing, you know. It's
Frozen or something.
Something like that. It was, but anyway, you know, trapped in a car, really good. So
there was one called Mud as well, where the person was stuck
in
the mud.
Yeah, there was, that's right. Yeah. So a lot of those kind of stuck in a car ones are pretty good. Well, apart from the one that we spoke about recently, which was that Anthony Hopkins one, which I can't remember the name of either. Capture, was it? No. 4x4 was the original Argentinian one, wasn't it? And the remake was called... Anyway, we spoke about that quite recently.
So, it was like an Uber sort of... some ride or something.
Something like that. Trapped in a car. So, anyway, those are my four films.
Trapped in a car. That's a great title.
Yeah.
Trapped in a car.
That wasn't it. But yeah,
people are parked close either side Tesco car park, and we're stuck. What can we do? Oh no, we're running out of sweeties.
So I thought that was a nice little scoop this last fortnight. Quite a few interesting little films came along, and I thought, yeah, let's jump in and do that. So I'll line up Project Hail Mary, and I think that's quite a nice little bundle.
Yeah, it's a lot of new releases for this show.
Mm.
Wow. And Primake, I think, is the biggest takeaway here.
Right.
I'm definitely going to watch that. Maybe this weekend.
Okay, then. Right. Let's see what is coming soon. What do we have?
Okay, well, I think for the umpteenth time, a film called Apex is coming out. This is hitting Netflix on the 24th of April. And it stars Charlize Theron and Taron Egerton. Eric Bana's in there as well, but he's not getting any sort of credit or poster title above title poster billing or something. But I love Eric Bana, so yeah, I'm mentioning him that. This is about an adrenaline junkie who sets out to conquer a menacing river. She discovers that nature isn't the only thing out for blood. It feels a wee bit kind of River Wild-y. Where she is stuck in the wilderness with some kind of psycho escape prisoner, deranged prisoner, something like that. I can't remember what it was. In about a week since I saw the trailer.
With a crossbow. with a giant crossbow.
I love these types of movies. You know, yeah. What was that? Naked and Afraid was the one with Joe Mantegna. And it's you know, sniper bearing down on someone who is running through a place, desert, snow, jungle in this case. What did you think of this?
Yeah, I thought it looked really good fun. And I was surprised at how, well Charlize Theron looked. She seems to have been around for quite a long time, really, but she looked really fit and looked younger than she clearly is.
I'm sure she would love to hear you.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. You've been around a long time, but you look fit.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. It was meant in the nicest possible way. But yeah, I'm with you on this kind of, you know, thrill kind of chase cat and mouse thing, and yeah, it's always good. Well, not always, but it's usually good fun. So yes,
just having a quick look at Taron Egerton, because he did Tetris, and then he did was it Check In or that one where he's the airport Security Guard, that was pretty good. But I was looking to see what else he's done, because he's a good actor, and I wanted to know if there was going to be a Blackbird Season 2 at some stage. But his next film's going to be called Everyone Wants to Fuck Me. I don't see that getting released with that title.
Good grief. Mind you, that one we spoke about before called Keep Out of the Fucking Attic or something, wasn't it? That was released with that in the title. Do you remember that one?
Yeah. Wasn't there a TV series as well? Because, like, my ex-boyfriend Colin or something recently, I think you watched that too. So, yeah. That just seems that you can't put it in. The C word's going to end up in movie titles soon. Right? Okay. Savage House.
The evolution of language. Right, go on.
Savage House is up next, and I got a wee bit excited about this because it reminded me a wee bit of how awesome Richard E. Grant is and how we don't get to see him, you know, really do what he does in that kind of With Neil and I or How to Get Ahead in Advertising type thing. And here he's combined with Claire Foy in a period drama, but this one seems to be a savagely comedic one, set in the 18th century England during the pox outbreak and Jacobite uprising. Sir Chauncey and Lady Savage blindly pursue better life, their pursuit filled with ironic decadence and bloodshed. A darkly satirical play on class and power. This is arriving in the cinemas on June 5th. What do you make of this, Ted? Do you like your period dramas?
Yeah, it looks really funny. It looks really funny, doesn't it? It might descend into silly, I guess, but I do like the set of it. I like the whole how it's been portrayed. It reminded me of that Jeffrey Rush film called Quills, where he plays the Marquis de Sade, and Kate Winslet is his girl, and it feels like it's kind of in that era, and it's got that style to it, I think. The only thing is that during the trailer, you kind of think, yeah, this could go a bit bonkers and silly, but yeah, I'm with you. I think it'll be definitely worth a look.
Yeah, looks decent enough. Unlike the next one. And I'm including this because I'm not praying that it's going to be good, but it's got one person in it I think is absolutely comedy dynamite, and that is Paul Walter Hauser. Speaking of Blackbird, actually, I'm hoping he's going to be the next sort of John Candy type character, actor that's in the best comedy movies. And this is the first big comedy movie that we've seen since Queenpins, I think. And it's called Balls Up. It's arriving on Amazon Prime on the 15th of April, and it's about two marketeers who pitch a bold new condom for the World Cup sponsorship. After a booze-filled scandal, they must outrun chaos to survive. Yeah, the trailer is hard to get through. It's a very American comedy, but I hope that this is much better than it looks to be. It's directed by Peter Farley, and we knew him from There's Something About Mary, and what didn't he do Outside Providence and Dumb and Dumber, and a number of great comedies back in the late 90s, early 2000s. It also has Mark Wahlberg, Sacha Baron Cohen, and Benjamin Bratt in there. So I'm just hoping it's a really bad trailer for what could be a decent comedy. Ted,
I think you might be disappointed, yeah. It just looks a complete load of tripe to me. Just stupid. And this is exactly the thing I can't stand watching. So move on.
All right. Okay. Something I won't be able to stand watching is Michael.
Oh, yeah, I put this in. Sorry.
Well, I saw this trailer because it comes before Project Hail Mary. I think it's the only trailer before that film, which was ridiculous, given the concept of what this is. This is a docudrama about an artist called Michael Jackson, who went on to sell a few records, I believe. He did a few good little ditties here and there throughout the 80s, I suppose. And it's directed by Antoine Fuqua. This is the story of the famous musician Michael Jackson, known as the King of Pop. And Ted, I feel you'd be better off talking about this one because I need.
I'm more interested in not his years of the King of Pop and Dance, which he did very efficiently later on, but more because of my age, I think. I grew up in the 1970s with two sisters in the house who kind of swooned over the Jacksons and the Osmonds and David Cassidy and the like, and I remember very clearly on Top of the Pops every week the Jackson Five were there and they were all kind of squeaky clean like the Osmonds, and it was all nice pop music, and it was much more to do with his early life that I'd be interested in this, I think. And from the trailer, it does look, to be honest, it looks like they've been able to recapture quite closely quite a lot of that with whoever they're using. So I guess this is going to be something for either someone of my age who grew up in the way with it, like in the way that I just described, or someone that came in later and who was wowed by the whole dancing thriller and bad stuff and all of that, who would be a bit older than me, I suppose, but possibly you fall between the two or just weren't. You can't identify with it very much, but I would be interested to watch this. I was no way a big Michael Jackson fan, but it will be nostalgic for me.
Yeah, I came to Michael Jackson whenever Bad came out, and the movie Moonwalker was all the rage, and I kind of latched onto that, but for the duration of that, and then whenever it was gone, I was done. I don't really care too much for the music that much. No. Michael Jackson is played by Jafar Jackson, who is his nephew in this. And I have to point out that when we were sitting in the cinema, there's about 45 seconds into the trailer, he does say, Michael says, "I know what I'm after." And then it cuts to some children running and screaming. And I wasn't the only person to turn around and go, "Oh dear, is that real?" And I was a little girl, so it wasn't quite accurate, but it was enough to make me think, that's a bit of a reminder of what he was actually after, potentially. But I dare say it's got a lot of the Michael Jackson estate influence in it, so it's not going to touch on certain things that he might have touched on over his lifetime, dare I suggest.
Allegedly.
Anyway, yes, allegedly. Possibly. Maybe. The last one we're going to talk about is Backrooms, which is a very exciting little horror science fiction type thing, in that guise of, found footage, Ted, that you don't like.
This is the one I mentioned. We were coming back to later, yeah.
the plot is, well, if anyone knows what Backrooms are, they'll know straight away. But a strange doorway appears in the basement of a furniture showroom. That's it. And that door leads to the Backrooms, which is what's it called? Curly Pasta. No, Creepy Pasta horror story. It's arriving on May 29th to cinemas. I think, yeah, it is cinemas. And Ted, what did you make of this?
There is a proper trailer out, which I put in the recording notes there, which I'll, because up until yesterday, all we had was this like 30-second teaser, but there is a proper trailer now, and it does fill it out a bit. It does look as though it's going to be quite good. It's an A24 project film, so, based on that, it's pretty good. Apparently, it's based on somebody called Kane Pixels' YouTube channel, where he visits creepy fictional places.
Kane Parsons.
Sorry?
Kane Parsons.
Kane Parsons, is it? Sorry. And he visits, yeah, creepy fictional place. I did actually go to the channel and watch one or two of these, and it was just all vomit-inducing, handheld camera, found footage stuff. And clearly it was just all fictional and made up, because they were quite upfront about that. But it seems to be based around that. But it felt as though it might be a bit more structured with this film, that it reminded me a bit of Severance, for example, and also the Malkovich film, Being John Malkovich, where he kind of goes in between the floors in a building, if you remember. It just had a kind of bit of that feel about it. So I'm not sure if I like it or not, but I'm definitely going to give it a go.
Yeah, I don't know if structure would work for Backrooms. I don't know. I'll wait until it arrives.
As always, we should wait till it arrives and then make our minds up. Right, okay, one last thing to do, which is to visit The Final Curtain and see who has not made it, and to see if I actually know anyone in here.
Well, it's a really tough one to do this time around, because there's a couple in here that are deeply upsetting. The first one is Valerie Perrine. Not a name that people may just sit up and go, oh my word. But whenever they remember her from Superman and Superman 2, they will go, oh yes, of course, Eve Tressmacher, who was Gene Hackman's girlfriend in those films. Very beautiful woman. Well known for a whole rake of movies. In 1974, she played opposite Dustin Hoffman in Lenny, and she was in W.C. Fields and Me, The Electric Horseman with Jane Fonda, The Agency with Robert Mitchum, Can't Stop the Music with Steve Guttenberg. And one thing that she doesn't really get too much credit for, but it's absolutely worth mentioning, is in The Cannonball Run. If you remember at the start of it, Adrian Barbeau and Tara Buckman are the beautiful ladies in the Lamborghini Countach, and they get pulled over by the police, and she's the female cop who is equally as beautiful as they are, going, yeah, you're not going to work that on me, or something like that. She was in The Border with Jack Nicholson, which was a really underrated thriller that seems to have been forgotten about over the years. I watched it a few years ago for the first time, and yeah, it was a really good Jack film. And after that, she became just a well-known character actress, popping up in all sorts of things, from TV to film, the odd episode of this and that, like Walker, Texas Ranger, Nash Bridges, and Northern Exposure, Burke's Law. Yeah, but very, very good actress and very entertaining. She passed away at the age of 82 on March 23rd. Know her?
She was in the aforementioned Water as well with Leonard Rossiter.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. We were talking about earlier. Once I saw her face, I did recognise it, and I picked out a picture with Lex Luthor, and it did come back to me. And I've seen that Jack Nicholson film at some point in the past. I would never have got there with just her name, like you can clearly do. But yes, having reviewed all of what you've just said, I have seen her, and I was aware of her. So yes, very sad.
Yeah, she was one of those actresses that, because of Superman, I had a bit of a crush on when I was young, and sort of followed her career and enjoyed whenever I saw her here and there popping out in bigger movies.
She was very pretty.
Very, very pretty indeed, and also a lovely person too.
Right.
Not that I knew her, of course, but I would have liked to. Next up is where do we begin? Chuck Norris passed away at the age of 86. He is one of the biggest names in action TV and movies. I don't know where to start with him, actually. He made a slew of movies in the late 70s. He's actually a wee bit better known for his martial arts career, not better known, but more accomplished at his martial arts career, where he was a perfect martial artist. And because of his martial arts career, I think he was in the Olympics or Commonwealth Games or something. Not Commonwealth Games, obviously, he was American. But he was cast in The Way of the Dragon to fight opposite Bruce Lee, to fight against Bruce Lee, in fact, because of his experience in martial arts and his dedication to the sports as an athlete, and that opened the door for a fairly interesting career that didn't sort of set the world alight. He did make a number of good films, but most of them were merely passable, and it was his on-screen persona, a bit like Arnold Schwarzenegger, that sold the films, but they didn't make big money at the box office. It was he was a very culty niche type action star, in the way that perhaps, you know, Bruce Campbell would be known for horror, and Curtis Armstrong would be known for, Robert Carradine would be known for comedy, those sorts of things. The Breaker Breaker and Good Guys Wear Black, A Force of One, The Octagon did quite well, not great, but quite well at the box office. And he would make the odd little movie in between, like Silent Rage, which wasn't, you know, your big martial arts film. It was actually a horror film at the main crux of it, where he plays a cop investigating who the killer is with Stephen First. I need to watch that again. That's a great film, actually. Silent Rage is good fun. Who's killing all these teenagers? And then he came back with a bunch more, Forced Vengeance. And then Lone Wolf McQuaid was supposed to be a really big film that saw him and Bruce Lee facing off again. But Bruce Lee passed away just before the film went into production, and David Carradine was hastily recast in the role that Bruce Lee would have occupied. After that, he signed a deal with Canon and made the Missing in Action series. And a film that I absolutely recommend anyone go out and watch, because it's such an interesting history as well. And it's actually had quite a lot of mentions whenever it comes to his filmography, and that's Code of Silence. It's a straight up action movie. It's not a martial arts action movie. It's a good old fashioned American cop movie. It was actually going to be one of the Dirty Harry movies, but Clint Eastwood said, "Nah, I'm a bit busy at the moment. Let's not do this." I think he was doing Pale Rider or something at the time. And Code of Silence then was, you know, slightly rewritten and turned into a Chuck Norris movie. And it's a great film from the director of The Fugitive, Andrew Baird, I think his name was. I think that's his most accomplished movie out of his entire career. It's the most solid, dependable, best film he's made. And then he had Invasion USA and the Delta Force series after that, and a ton of Canon films right up until the 90s, whenever he appeared in a TV series that went on to make him legendary, which was Walker, Texas Ranger. And there was 196 episodes of that, and a couple of feature films that spun off from that, or TV movies that spun off from that. And he kind of worked on action TV movies after that, and semi-retired in the early 2000s, where he and his wife started working on charities and things like that. But he popped back up again in The Expendables 2 in a very well-placed cameo. And one of the main reasons to watch that film, because the rest of it was a bit crap, to be honest. And then he made a wee bit of a comeback, making movies closer to today. And he was in a video game as well called Crime Boss. Didn't do terribly well. But I think his last film was called Zombie Plane. And I don't know if it's been released yet, but it stars Chuck Norris and Vanilla Ice. And I'd hate to think that was where he went out. But IMDb gives it 8.6 out of 10. So maybe it's a classic that no one's ever seen. I don't know. But, you know, his action movies are the best to open up a beer, sit back with your mates and have a laugh with, because they are just so entertaining in that 1980s martial artsy type way. They're a bit schlocky, kind of funny, but action-packed and thrilling. You can get what you want whenever you sit down to watch them. You know exactly what you're going to get. And he was a bit of a legend. The whole mythos as well about Chuck Norris as well, the Chuck Norris facts were so entertaining. And he himself loved them too. And he you can go onto YouTube and see him reading some of them out. And one of my favorite ones was, I'll probably get it wrong, but Chuck Norris, whenever he turned 18 and left home, he told his father that he was the man of the house now. I thought that was terrific. Ted, you're not totally 100% on who Chuck Norris is, are you?
I have no idea who he is. And all of those things that you just spoke about at great length, all of them are reasons why he's not on my radar, because that's just not what I go for in film and TV. But I have heard you and Alan talking about him, and you know, in the past, so the name did kind of ring a bell. But when I trailed through the filmography and tried to dig a bit deeper to try and find some common ground with me, there's just nothing, Gareth. It really is barren, and I, you know, it's just not my thing.
Okay. Top Dog. Top Dog was a movie that came out in 1995. It was a bit like K-9 and Turner and Hooch, those types of pair a celebrity off with a dog, and they're both cops, and they have to track down a criminal together. And it was really quite good, to be honest. I really enjoyed Top Dog. I'm ashamed to admit that, but I've totally forgot about it. I meant to review it for my site. I watched it about 5 or 6 years ago and thought it was so much better than I anticipated.
Do you know, I've got a feeling I might have seen The Way of the Dragon.
I'd like to think you have.
Yeah, I think I have. Because I did watch Enter the Dragon back in the day. That was all the thing when I was kind of growing up as a young teenager. And everyone was into Enter the Dragon. So The Way of the Dragon presumably was after that, was it?
It's not connected to it, though. They just happen to have a similar title.
Oh, okay. I think I might have seen that one. So, yes, perhaps I have seen something he's in. Yes.
Okay. He's got very hairy shoulders in Way of the Dragon.
Right.
If memory serves me well, yeah. Okay. But, yes, it's very sad to hear the passing of Chuck Norris. And everyone's jaw hit the table, aside from Ted's, whenever that was announced. Because, you know, we did actually figure that he was immortal and he would outlive us all.
Yes.
All, everyone, even your great-great-great-great-grandchildren. So the last one we have to talk about is Jamie Blanks, who is an actor, director, composer as well. But I'm pretty much going to talk about his directing career, because he directed a couple of films that I feel really ought to be mentioned and celebrated. Two more so than all three of them. Urban Legend was a horror film in 1998 that I know had a lot of buzz about it. I heard about it from people going, oh, have you seen this? Have you seen this? And people got really excited about it. I think they even franchised it. There was a couple of sequels, I believe. Maybe. Yes, there were several sequels, in fact. But yes, he directed that and did a fantastic job. Now, I haven't seen it since about 1999, and I should have revisited it. But he followed it up with a Denise Richards horror movie called Valentine that I remember going to see in the cinema, because it was from the director of Urban Legend. And it was quite good. It wasn't as good as Urban Legend, but it was still a decent enough horror film. But the third film, which was a good few years later, caught me completely by surprise. And I think, again, it was in the After Dark film festival, was Storm Warning, which is a little Australian horror film. And yeah, horror, I'd say a wee bit more action-y as well, about a couple who are sort of stuck in an isolated farmhouse on an island, and there's I seem to remember being Australian, like, rednecky type people attacking them and things. It is. It's not exploitation. That's right. I am remembering quite well. But my wife and I watched that and thought, this is brilliant. It was really cool. And I know I got a big 4K recently, just after I tracked down and bought the now out of print Blu-ray of it. But yeah, that's one absolute to go out and find. And I know Jamie Blanks for that. And I thank Jamie Blanks for that film because it was great. Have you ever heard of any of those?
No, I haven't, I'm afraid. But
but you'll have to catch up with them.
Yeah, I Storm Warning. Is that some? No. I'm trying to think. I'm thinking of something else. But no, I'm sorry. I can't contribute to this conversation at all.
They're quite niche, sort of teeny horror movies, if anything, for the kids of the late 90s. So I would have been a bit surprised if you'd seen them, unless you just happened to hire out the video one night thinking, I fancy it.
But it seems that most of his stuff is around writing music and soundtracks, doesn't it?
Yeah. I know he composed the soundtrack to... Was it a Crawl Space or something like that?
Yeah.
I figured I'd seen, but I can't say I've seen too many of his other films that he's actually composed.
That rings a bell, Crawl Space. Do you know, I think I might have seen that.
I think there's a few films called Crawl Space. I don't know. It's the one that I'm thinking of that was released a few years ago. And it's certainly not the one with Klaus Kinski from the early 80s.
Okay.
But he edited together Electric Boogaloo, which was the terrific documentary about Canon Films, and that's a marvelous documentary, and he did phenomenal work there in making such an engaging. He also did Not Quite Hollywood. All right, okay. Which is another documentary about exploitation, which is kind of funny because he made an exploitation film. I've seen that too, right? Yeah, Quentin Tarantino was in that too. Yeah, so he's a really good editor of note as well, because editing documentaries is not an easy feat. And I heard a feature film editor once saying that he couldn't do a documentary. Feature films are actually easier, which is madness, I suppose. But yeah,
I reckon
so there you go. You might have seen those.
I reckon you are Tarantino.
Nope.
This conversation is just the kind of one I'd imagine that a person could have with Tarantino, where he just knows everything about everything to do with films. And
this conversation is one where you can't get a word in, a bit like anyone who's talking to Quentin Tarantino.
But yeah, absolutely. Your knowledge base is just really impressive about just everything to do with films. It's incredible. So take that as a compliment.
Thanks. I don't know how to take compliments. He was also one of the camera operators on the making of Baba Hotep. Okay. Jamie Blanks, I salute you, sir.
Anyway, do we know how old he was? He wasn't particularly young, was he?
No, he... Oh, it doesn't actually say. It doesn't say his date of birth at all. But yes, he was quite young. I'd say he was maybe in his late 40s.
Oh, right. Oh, dear. Jamie Blanks. See if we can find out. Jamie Blanks.
K-S.
Well, you know, I mean, it was close. Now, you see, Tarantino would have known this.
Oh, 1970.
Yes, 1971. So, 81, 91, 2001, 2011, 2021. He's 55.
54.
Okay.
November 71.
Fair enough.
March 16th, which... Yeah, it's very sad to hear that, and it's worth going back and visit. Ted, there's three films you can watch. Storm Warning. Yeah. Urban Legend, and the other one we discussed earlier on in the show.
Okay.
And anything Chuck Norris.
Okay. Yeah, all right. Thanks very much for all that Gareth, your research. No, not your research, or just your natural knowledge. This is the end of the show. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another one. GarethMiles.com is an interesting website where you can learn all sorts of stuff. So head across there. SethSalmon.com is the boring one, which just links you out to MeWe Groups and our other audio podcasts.
Nonsense, poopy pants.
Podhub UK is where you'll find the rest of it. And our website is projectorroom.co.uk. So you'll find everything you need in there if you can't find it in your podcatcher. And yes, we'll see you next time, in 2 weeks' time, in fact, when we hope you'll join us again in the projector room.